From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a talk about acting with Annabella Sciorra, the star of such films as True Love, Jungle Fever, The Hand That Rocks the Cradle, The Addiction, Copland, and Mr. Jealousy. She stars opposite Robin Williams in the new film, What Dreams May Come. Also, we talk with Lenny Kaye about his archaeological dig into garage rock of the mid-60s. His 1972 anthology, Nuggets, has just been expanded into a 4-CD box set. Lenny Kaye is also Patti Smith's longtime guitarist. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
Support for NPR comes from Tor Books, publisher of Robert Jordan's The Path of Daggers, available wherever books are sold starting October 20th.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Actress Annabella Sciorra is best known for her starring roles in the comedy True Love, the Spike Lee film Jungle Fever, and the hit thriller The Hand That Rocks the Cradle. Earlier this year, she starred opposite Eric Stoltz in the romantic comedy Mr. Jealousy, in which she played an art historian. Here she is conducting a museum tour.
Personage is a very good example of his fascination with not just the human body, but the terror and the loneliness of the human condition.
The figure is almost faceless. All you can see are the eyes and the mouth.
She's right. All I can see are the eyes and the mouth.
The eyes and the mouth, except for I personally think that that's an ear, but, you know, I've been told that it's not an ear, so I guess everybody else is right. But I think, doesn't it look like an ear? It looks like an ear.
Annabella Sciorra is now starring opposite Robin Williams in the film What Dreams May Come. The movie is set in heaven and hell as well as on earth. Annabella Sciorra loses her children in a car accident, then loses her husband in another one. Her husband and children go to heaven, leaving her to grieve alone on earth. In fact, she's in tears for much of the film. I asked Sciorra if she had to summon up tears for these scenes, if she was ever able to rely on artificial ones.
You know, I don't ever obligate myself to have tears or to have laughter or to have any of the final emotion or product that you see. It was a set where it was very open. There were a lot of takes that instead of crying, I am laughing or, you know, or in shock or, you know, something else is going on. And it was just a matter of the director deciding which way he wanted to go with all of that. I think that there are times you can fake stuff, you know, you can fake, you know, stuff if the director wants something that's really not the way you naturally want to go. But on this movie, I think we had a lot of freedom to just stay in the moment and stay with what was going on.
Annabella Sciorra, I know you were born in Connecticut, and then I think you moved to New York when you were how old?
11.
11. Did you think of yourself as having a New York accent as you were growing up?
I did have a slight accent during a certain period of my life, in order to fit in, I think, with the people I was going to school with.
Is that something that you then had to try to lose for some roles and then play up for other roles?
Yeah, I was very fortunate to find a dialect coach when I was 16 or 17, I think. Her name was Deborah Ross Sullivan, and she was actually from the Bronx, and she studied with a woman named Edith Skinner. And she taught me that having a New York accent wasn't the coolest thing in the world, and I could afford losing it, and if I wanted it back, I could get it back.
I have a question about your voice. Now, in your movies, you've had many roles where you've had to use your voice very forcefully. I mean, from one of your earliest roles in True Love, where you play, you know, a bride, to even in Mr. Jealousy. I mean, you're very assertive in that, and you're speaking in a very small voice right now, which is different from the voice I'm used to on screen.
Yeah.
It seems much more tentative to me.
I think that I think it's One of the reasons I thought acting was so interesting is because I grew up very shy and very tentative, and I always felt like the roles I was playing and what came out of me while I was acting was always much more interesting than who I was. I felt like I had a much larger landscape of life in my acting than I did in my real life. And I tend not to be that loud or forceful in my real life.
Mm-hmm. I think the first role that a lot of people noticed you in was in True Love, which was Nancy Savoca's first film, the first film she directed. And you play, a bride, a woman getting married. You're from the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And your husband-to-be is acting a little dumb and reluctant about the whole thing. How did you get the part?
There's two stories about how it happened, and I don't really remember which is true, but I'm pretty sure that I got a call from a casting director named Todd Thaler, who had my picture and resume for one reason or another, and he was casting the movie. And I was supposed to go in and audition, and I couldn't make it because I was working as a bartender at the time. And I think I missed about three of those auditions, and then finally did make it in one afternoon. And I auditioned for Nancy and her husband Rich, who was the producer, and they co-wrote the film by doing a monologue that I had written.
Do you remember the monologue, and would you do a few lines from it?
I can remember the first line because I remember the first line was I'm Italian, right? And I remember that because when I said it, Nancy said, yeah. And I said, no, I just started the monologue. And that's why I remember that very first line. But, it was like, I'm Italian, right? So things are either good or they're bad. There's no in between. It started like that. She was trying to explain to somebody. She was being asked out on a date, and her boyfriend just broke up with her, and she was trying to explain, like, who she was and set this guy up about, what he was in for.
Now, was that voice similar to the voice that you had before losing your New York accent, or is that just something that you got for the movie? Because it's very, very convincing.
I think it's not really what I had. I think it's a much more Italian, American, New York accent, mm-hmm. which is more down here. It's more that. Mm. A lot of, they use a lot of D's, in place of T's. It wasn't exactly what I had because I didn't grow up with that many Italian Americans, but I think that's what I tried to give Donna as well.
And then you were in Spike Lee's Jungle Fever, which you played opposite Wesley Snipes. He was an architect, and you're having a relationship that is frowned on by friends and family on both sides because it's interracial. I'm wondering if there was a lot of discussion about that on the set, about, interracial relationships.
I guess there was, yeah. I think it was talked about a lot. I think that there were people on that set who thought that it wasn't good. It wasn't a good thing. That people should stay with their own kind, were the words that were used. I think even Spike at the time, from what I remember, he did not think it was good for that to happen. To me, it wasn't anything that unusual from the world I grew up in, and I didn't really find it that shocking or different. I think also I saw it as a love story. I didn't really see it as much as this curiosity relationship about what is black like, what is white like, which I think is more how Spike saw it. So at the time, I think we disagreed a little bit about that, but there were many creative discussions, that revolved around that.
Now, what happens in a movie where the director feels that the character is having this relationship just to kind of try out a new flavor, so to speak. But you, the actor, thinks, no, this is more serious. She feels for the person. It's not a novelty. I mean, it's mm-hmm. just, it's a real relationship. Who wins? I mean, do you win because you're the actress and you're finally doing it, or does the director win because he insists on a certain performance and chooses the take that's closest to what he wants?
Well, the director wins because the director is the boss, and, you know, it's an actor's job to fulfill his wishes, really. I mean, that's your job. If you really have such a huge disagreement about what's going on and what the story is, then you really shouldn't work in the movie, and you know, it should be recognized in, beforehand, so you don't get into a really bad situation working on a movie where you're trying to make two different movies. I think that, unfortunately, I think with Spike, I don't think that we understood each other before the movie started, so I think we did get into some situations where we disagreed about stuff. But I think ultimately, when I look at that movie, I think Spike really gave me my moments. I think he understood what I was doing, and, you know, ultimately, he could have made it into something else. He could have cut a lot of it out. He could have dropped a lot of those moments. And I think ultimately he gave me my moments, and everything that I wanted that character to be is in that movie. So I think it worked out for both of us.
My guest is Annabella Sciorra. She stars in the new film, What Dreams May Come. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Annabella Sciorra. She stars in the new film, What Dreams May Come. The Hand That Rocks the Cradle was a huge commercial success and started this whole trend of movies that were trying to capitalize on the suspense theme in that, and that you play a young mother who hires the babysitter from hell who you know, takes over and totally, you know, tries to ruin the family. Did you have any idea it would be such a big hit, or did you just think it would be, you know, another thriller?
No, I had no idea it would be a big hit. I think that there were days on the set that I would laugh so hard because I thought it was just the stupidest thing I was ever going to be in. But I think, to the director's credit, Curtis Hanson and John Link, who's the editor on the movie, and the producers, John Madden, I think that they turned it into a really great movie of that genre. And I came to appreciate that type of movie, I think.
So it's possible to make a movie and not be aware of how good or bad it is as you're making it?
I don't think you ever can, no. Because I've been on movies that I thought were just going to be so amazing and really turned out to me to be disappointing.
Mm-hmm.
Or not only disappointing, but different from the movie I thought I was in.
Can you think of an example?
Well, let's see. I did a movie called Whispers in the Dark that I thought was a really, really interesting psychological thriller when I read it for the first time. And I did not like the movie at all. I don't think I liked one moment of the movie. I thought it was trash. I think if I were the producer, he's a great producer, and he's made great movies in his career. But I would have done something else with it, I think.
So, now you've also done a couple of movies with Abel Ferrara, who does a lot of speaking of perverse, I mean, he does a lot of very strange independent films. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering what his approach to directing is.
He's got a
He did The Bad Lieutenant and The Addiction,
right.
The Funeral.
He did The Addiction and The Funeral, and he's done a lot of great movies. You've got to like working with him to work with him, because it's the set is extremely creative but extremely chaotic.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm very into it. I really like being on his sets. In fact, I've said this before and it's still true. There's nothing I wouldn't do with Abel. You know, he could ask me to stand in my head and do a scene, and I would do it.
Why? What is it about him that would
I just
get
trust
you to follow
him? I trust him. I trust his instincts. Because he has a lot of respect for the people that he works with, which is why he has been working with the same cinematographer for 18 years. And, you know, he works with the same production designer and costume designer and the same actors over and over again, because there's a real respect, a real mutual respect for what's going on and people's processes. And, I look forward to working with him again. We talk about it, and we might do something this winter together.
Can you put your finger on what else differentiates a good director for actors from a bad or mediocre one?
I think that the respect factor is important. You sometimes take for granted that when a director hires actors, he actually respects what they do and trusts their acting. But quite often that doesn't happen. And so they're not only telling you what they want in the scene, but they're also trying to tell you how to act, and they're trying to tell you how to get there, which is very frustrating, because you can't take an actor who knows the way that they work and try to change it. And if there's no respect, and if that's missing, and if there's no trust, then you also aren't free to really talk about what you're doing, because it's not really important. And again, you don't need to talk about what you're doing, but, I mean, a director is there to direct you, and you need that guidance. You want that guidance as an actor, because you can't watch yourself and act at the same time.
So it sounds like what you want from a director is a sense of feedback, maybe, but not advice on how to get from here to there in a role, not an advice on how to get to the point of embodying the character, because that's a very personal...
Yeah, it's very personal, and a lot of times in sets you have, you know, directors do this, what I call method directing, and they like to, you know, push actors emotionally into a situation.
Like how?
Oh, they just, I've seen them do it all, I've seen it so many times, I've seen directors... yell at actors to get them to cry or to intimidate them. And people, you know, there's even, I've even heard stories of Ilya Kazan doing it with a face in the crowd. And it's just infuriating to me. It's really disrespectful.
As if, like, you didn't have the technique to get there through your own technique.
Right, yeah. And if you don't have the technique, then why did you hire me? You know, why do you hire somebody if you don't respect or trust what they're going to do? So it starts off in a bad place, I think, when it starts off like that.
Has someone ever tried to do that to you on the set? Try to, like, humiliate you so you look humiliated on screen for a scene?
Yeah, yeah.
Did you realize what was happening as it was happening?
Yes. It doesn't really work with me because I get really pissed off.
So is that what you did? You just got angry?
yeah, because it takes you out. For me, it takes me out of what I'm doing, you know. They may as well be talking about, you know, Chinese food while I'm trying to act. If they start doing that, it's annoying.
So how is it resolved?
And distracting. How is it resolved? Well, it's a delicate situation, because if you come right out and tell them that what they're doing is annoying, then they're going to be hurt and insulted and realize that maybe they don't know how to direct. And so you have to be very delicate about it. And, you know, politely, you know, tell them that, you know, it takes you, that, you know, if they're going to behave like that, then you have to sort of pretend that you're in that same world with them and say that, you know, maybe it takes you out of the moment if they talk while you're acting or something like that.
Now, it seems to me that you're an actress who has come up pretty independently. Some actors and actresses start in a group of people who are associated with a certain period or era or type of film or repertory company or something, and they seem to, like, move together for the first 3 years of their career. You never had that, for better or worse.
Oh, I see what you're saying. No, I didn't. I was never really part of a group like that.
It sounds like it's probably in your nature to not be part of a group like that.
I think it is, too. It's something that I always found attractive, but from a distance. I think it was because I was shy and because it was hard for me to be around that many people, and it was hard for me to be part of a group. I was also always very secretive about my work, even. It was always very hard for me to talk about my work. I didn't understand how people sat around and talked about their work. It just was so stupid to me, you know.
Let me ask you, since there does seem to be such a contrast between how who you are as yourself and who you are in character, and that you're much more, you know, withdrawn and just the observer as yourself. Do you ever walk in for an audition or after you've gotten the part and find that the casting director or the film director thinks like, well, no, they can't possibly do this. Look how quiet, look how small they seem in real life. They can't play this character. I've made a terrible mistake, or I can't possibly give her the role in spite of what I've seen from other performances.
I think it does happen. I mean, I feel like it's happened, and I also feel, you know, starting you would go into a situation and you would audition to get a role, and then as you start, your work starts to get known, you come in to just to have a meeting with the director, and that was always very uncomfortable to me because, or you have a meeting and then an audition, you know, it would be different than it was before, because coming in to audition, you can pretty much just give them what they want, and I think that it's more comfortable for everybody for them just to think that you possess those qualities naturally, rather than to come in and talk intellectually about a character, to talk as yourself. It shows them a part of you that they, you know, maybe don't really want to see in the character, and they're obviously going to see it. You know, they're going to see it, and it's going to affect how they see you. And how they see you as the character.
So how do you respond to those kinds of auditions where a lot of the audition is just speaking about the role with the director?
It's tricky. I mean, it's very tricky. It's I'm not very good at it. I don't feel very comfortable with it. I still would rather audition. Mm-hmm. I'd rather come in and just if it's a situation where we don't know yet, like if it's not an offer and we're, you know, it's in the talking stages of do I want to do this, do they want me to do it, it's easier for me to just come in and do it and say, look, you know, this is kind of how I see the role right now. You know, obviously there's a lot of changes and things, and but here's a part of me that I think I would like to express in this role, and even that can be tricky because sometimes you see it a certain way right now, but it's not necessarily how you would play it in 2 months or 6 months. So you're also trying to negotiate that. You know, it's altogether it would be just much better if I was in a theater company.
Annabella Sciorra, she stars in the new film What Dreams May Come. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Coming up, we talk with Lenny Kaye about the new expanded version of his 1972 anthology Nuggets, a collection of mostly obscure or forgotten garage rock of the mid-60s. Kaye is also Patti Smith's longtime guitarist. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the mid-60s, in between the start of the British invasion and the domination of progressive rock, teenagers around America were starting bands, rehearsing in their parents' garages, imitating the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, the Kinks, Bob Dylan, and other hitmakers of the day. Some of those bands went into the studio and made one great record. In 1972, Lenny Kaye collected some of those one-hit wonders and some of the great but obscure singles of the period. His anthology, Nuggets, is now considered one of the most important and influential documents of 60s garage rock. Lenny Kaye went on to become Patti Smith's guitarist. Now he's co-produced an expanded version of Nuggets on Rhino Records. It's a 4-CD box set featuring 118 songs, including the 27 from the original double album. Lenny Kaye, welcome to Fresh Air.
Pleasure to be here.
I want to start by asking you to choose a record from the original Nuggets that pretty well defines what the project is all about, a record you still love.
Well, when Joey Ramone had a birthday party at Coney Island High a couple months ago, I strapped on Pushing Too Hard by the Seeds, and I realized it was the first time I played it ever, and it is quite a rockin' song and seems to me to be the very definition of what a garage band should be.
The first time you played it, you mean the first time you performed it?
That's the first time I ever sang it from start to finish, and it's not as easy as it seems, I must say.
Oh, why not?
The guitar break has a certain elemental simplicity, but it kind of moves around in a nice way, and we also amped it up a little bit, so it had a kind of 90s velocity to it. But it's a really great song. It's got two whole chords, and it's got the kind of a spit out lyrics that to me really define what was happening in rock and roll in the mid 60s here in America.
Okay, and this is Pushing Too Hard, the Seeds from Nuggets.
You're pushing too hard, you're pushing on me. You're pushing too hard on what you want me to be. You're pushing too hard about the things you say. You're pushing too hard every night and day. You're pushing too hard, pushing too hard on me. Well, all I want is to just be free, live my life the way I wanna be. All I want is to just have fun, live my life like I just begun. But you're pushing too hard, pushing too hard.
That's Pushing Too Hard from 1966, one of the recordings included on the original anthology Nuggets, produced by my guest, Lenny Kaye. Lenny Kaye, what's the story behind how Nuggets was first produced?
Well, I was introduced to Jack Holzman, who was the president of Elektra Records, around the end of 1970. I had been chosen, for reasons that escaped me, to be one of the heavy hundred of rock and roll in Esquire magazine. I was their token rock critic. I think it was because I'd written a favorable review of the Stooges' first album. And Jack Holzman called me up. He was a very literate record company president and liked the input of the press and also did groups that had a certain intellectual edge, like The Doors and Love, the MC5 and the Stooges. And he asked me to be a kind of A&R freelance scout at the time. In the end, none of the groups that I brought him, he really was interested in, and vice versa. But one of the projects he had, and I think it was because he just gotten one of the first cassette machines, was he wanted to do an album called Nuggets, which consisted of those tracks from albums that only had one good track. I think his idea was to clean out his record collection. And he passed it over to me, and I kind of spun it toward the kind of teen bands that I grew up listening to as a wild animal in New Jersey with my own teen band. And over the course of a year, they gathered together these songs that I'd chosen. The initial list was pretty broad and vague because I didn't quite have an idea of what I was doing. Some of these songs were only 4 to 5 years old. And they got the rights to a bunch of them, and as more of these licensings came in, I started seeing just exactly what the shape of the era was about.
What was it about?
Well, it was about a sudden sense of possibility that came over American rock and roll at the time. You had a lot of inputs, a certain sense that you could borrow and steal freely from all kinds of music. That the time of the 3-minute hit single was becoming obsolete, and that a rock band could move into areas of new areas of texture, of sound, of instrumental overkill, and a sense that nobody really knew what to do with all these new sounds and possibilities. You had a lot of bands partaking of the atmosphere of the 60s, and even though the decade is kind of clouded in complete cliche and stereotype now, there was a feeling of expanding horizons.
So what qualified a record for inclusion on the original Nuggets?
In the original Nuggets, it was mostly if I liked it. And my thing for inclusion was that it had to be a really great song that was not quite a major hit, nor a complete collector obscurity. I was very conscious of making a listening album. My models were, on the one hand, the more academic hand, the Yazoo Blues collections, Blues of Southwest Georgia, 1928 to 32, you know, very scholarly, you know. And on the other hand, when I was a kid, I used to get these Mr. Maestro oldies compilations, you know, 20 original hits, you know, a guy with a motorcycle and some wild babe riding next to him, and, you know, kind of just a bunch of great songs. And so my thought was that, you know, to make a record that was really fun to listen to of these records that were not that easy to get a hold of, or that you had to dig them off records that, you know, the group had vanished in the haze. It was only as the retrospect, you know, as the hindsight grew, that I began to see just how much of a genre I was mining. I think as the years passed, the sense of what a garage band is, you know, that sense of punk rock as it's kind of a borning, you know, became clearer, not only to me, but to the people who heard Nuggets and kind of made it a touchstone for a type of music.
Let's pause here to listen to another track from the original volume of Nuggets. And this is from the group Count Five. It's called Psychotic Reaction. And this got some radio play. I think people who were listening to radio at the time will know this. Tell me what you think this song represents within the collection.
I think one of the major influences on these bands was the British Invasion. Possibly because before then, most bands with guitars were kind of either surf bands, very instrumental-oriented, or a little bit more like, say, Johnny and the Hurricanes. Again, very instrumental. And seeing a group like the Beatles or the Rolling Stones on Ed Sullivan inspired all these bands to kind of want to be like them. Of all the English bands, I think the most influential on the garage bands were the Yardbirds, because they seemed to push the envelope of sound sonically so much further. They had incredible guitar players, Jeff Beck, Eric Clapton early on, and that fuzz-tony sound that the Yardbirds had in a song like Over Under Sideways Down or I'm a Man really turned musicians on in America. You know, again, you're seeing a whole new palette of sound. The Count Five were from San Jose in California, and they really got that Yardbird sound and had a fairly large hit on it. I certainly might not have been in the top 10, but it grazed there. And, you know, that's about all you need to become a rock and roll star for your moment in time.
Okay, here's the Count Five, Psychotic Reaction.
You're the best girl that I've ever had. I can't get your love, I can't get affection. Oh, little girl, psychotic reaction. And it feels like this.
Psychotic Reaction, the Count Five, from the original volume of Nuggets produced by my guest, Lenny Kaye. There's three new volumes that have been added to that in the new Rhino Nuggets box set. Now, just about all the bands included in Nuggets, and I think completely all the bands on Volume One, were you know, white male teenagers.
Yes, and you know something? I only realized just how male this album was right as it was going to press. Because, you know, to me, the female spirit in rock and roll is extremely important. And as a matter of fact, on today's music scene, there are incredible female garage rockers, I could say. The Pandoras, the Pristines from New York, the Donnas from San Francisco. And I really feel like that's a certain element that was missed. There's not a lot of recorded remains left. I only know of four or five actual female bands from that time. But, you know, I do think that is an oversight in the current Nuggets box.
My guest is Lenny Kaye. He's co-produced a new expanded 4-CD version of his 1972 garage rock anthology, Nuggets. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Lenny Kaye, Patti Smith's guitarist. He's co-produced a new expanded 4-CD version of his 1972 garage rock anthology, Nuggets. your first volume of Nuggets came out in 1972, and
yes.
Now three more volumes have been added to it. Some of the records on those three volumes are records that you would have liked to include on volume one, but you didn't have the rights to release them on your anthology. I'd like you to choose one of those records you would have liked to include on the first edition of Nuggets that is now on volume two, three, or four.
Well, part of the list that was generated for the newer volumes came from my proposed second volume that never actually saw the light of day or even the light of licensing. But there are definitely records that I thought would stand alongside anything on the first Nuggets and actually would flesh out the story. One of them, my favorites, is a group from Los Angeles called The Lollipop Shop. They did a song called You Must Be a Witch. And just it's a great slab of mid-60s Arcana.
Anything else you want to say about it? I think it's going to be very unfamiliar to just about everyone.
Well, it's fairly unfamiliar to me, to be honest. I don't know too much about who The Lollipop Shop were, except this really is about their only stab at glory. And I know the area of the country. They gave it a good shot.
Okay, this is the band Lollipop Shop. The Lollipop Shop. It has a little element of You're Pushing Too Hard in it, don't you think?
They all have a little element of each other in it.
That's right.
I mean, it was really like a sound of the time. And you can hear, you know, the fact that that feedback, they've discovered the magic feedback. They've discovered this kind of snarled vocal, which is probably delivered, you know, straight on from the Rolling Stones. They've discovered the sense of their own kind of, you know, inner power. And some of these records don't sound a million miles away from, you know, rock as it is today.
Listening back to the Nuggets recordings, what would you say were the most influential records on the bands included in Nuggets?
I would say, you know, things like The Shadows of Night, The Blues Project.
Question mark of the Mysterians. Don't you think that 96 Tears and its organ line is one of the most influential things?
Yes, but you know it's not on the current Nuggets because that song is just impossible to license.
Don't you think 96 Tears, though, influenced a lot of the bands on Nuggets?
I think 96 Tears influenced them. I think, in a sense, they influenced each other. It's hard to pick out one track because it was like a cauldron at the time, and it was spread out across America. I mean, you know, you had, like, in every small town in America, bands that were getting together and learning how to play their instruments and suddenly, you know, seizing the tail of the tiger. I think that all of them partook of a certain sound, and that their time was almost, in a way, limited because the music was changing so quickly, it would, by the end of the 60s, have a whole different feel. Amplifier technology was moving so quickly that, in a sense, the Nuggets bands would sound, their textures would sound differently. People would move from a Farfisa organ, this little toy organ almost, to the big sound of the Hammond. It was kind of, they were caught. I always think of it as, you know, in around 1964, all these bands left one side of the river, and then they're kind of in the middle of the river, and they're being tossed by the currents and everything. When they get to the other side, rock and roll has changed. But I like that middle time when people are kind of a little bit not sure of where they're going and what they're doing with it, and they're just trying to... They're experimenting. It's very unpredictable music within its kind of genre.
My guest is Lenny Kaye. He's co-produced a new expanded 4-CD version of his 1972 garage rock anthology, Nuggets. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Lenny Kaye, Patti Smith's guitarist. He co-produced a new expanded 4-CD version of his 1972 garage rock anthology, Nuggets. The song Hey Joe was included on the original edition of Nuggets, which you produced. And then that song was also on Patti Smith's first 45.
Yes, that's true. There is some...
I mention this because, you know, as our listeners may know, you're Patti Smith's long-term guitarist. So make that connection for me between the Hey Joe on Nuggets and Patti Smith's Hey Joe.
Well, Patti always described what we did, especially, you know, in the pre-Horses time, as we were kind of like Paul Revere riding around saying, wake up, wake up.
But not, you know, like Paul Revere and the Raiders.
Well, actually, we, you know, Just Like Me is a great song. It was a sense where we wanted not to lose the spirit of the music that we loved. Obviously, you know, we tapped into a lot of 60s stuff. It was certainly a mythic time for rock and roll, or the rock and roll that created us. We did Gloria, which is probably the classic, quintessential garage classic. And Hey Joe really seemed to tell a certain story about where we stood in relation to the music that gave us energy.
And who did the original?
The original was written by, actually, Dino Valenti under the name of Chester Powers, for reasons. I believe The Leaves might have one of the original. I know Love covered it. It was kind of in common currency at the time. I chose The Leaves version just because it seemed... the most exciting, the fastest.
Okay, and this is from 1966.
Hey, Joe, where you going with that gun in your hand?
Hey Joe, The Leaves, recorded in 1966, included on the original version of Nuggets, and also featured on the new expanded box set. Lenny Kaye was the producer of the original Nuggets. He's also Patti Smith's longtime guitarist. And that was the song that you and Patti Smith did on your first single together. Patti Smith has started recording again in the past few years. There was a long period where she wasn't recording, and therefore you weren't touring with her. What's it like to be back on the road together?
It's rather wonderful. You know, Patti is perhaps the best performer I've ever seen in my life. I've had a really great position on the stage with her for most of it, so I get to see all the subtleties. And it's really wonderful that she's taking her art out to the people again.
Was it frustrating for you during that long period when she wasn't performing?
No, to be honest, I never thought that we would perform again together. We had done our work in the 70s. There was a certain sense of completion to it. We had a great tale beginning in front of, 100 people at St. Mark's Church on the Lower East Side and ending in a soccer stadium in Florence in front of 70,000 people. You can't write a better movie than that. And I had no hope for a sequel. I felt that Patti had gone off and followed her artistic muse, and so myself. But what I like most about the band at this moment in time is that there is a real sense of present to it. This is, we're not particularly nostalgic. We're certainly not into the sense of revival. We pay tribute to our history, but the work that we're doing at the present, we feel, is as valid as anything we did in the 70s. And Patti, of course, is an artist who's here for a lifetime, and her muse will take us wherever, she may. But there's a sense that we're really working in this current moment on things that perhaps need to be said.
Why don't we go out with some more music from Nuggets? I was thinking, when I was listening to the new collection, mm-hmm. I had this, the one moment when I experienced this, like, wow, I haven't heard this in a really long time. This really sounds great, was Nobody But Me.
Great tune.
Yeah, and it's like the dance tune on Nuggets.
Well, it's not so different than Shout, and I remember playing Shout in New Jersey fraternity houses for 20 minutes while the brothers did their backstroke in the beer on the floor. But, it's those two chords, a great hit.
Well, let's go out with that from the Nuggets collection on Rhino Records. My guest is Lenny Kaye, who produced the original edition of Nuggets and is one of the producers on the expanded edition. Lenny Kaye is also Patti Smith's longtime guitarist. Lenny Kaye, thanks again. I'm Terry Gross,
pleasure.
And this is Fresh Air. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Joan Tui Westman, with Alan Tu, Monique Nazareth, and Anne-Marie Baldonado. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Columbia Records, presenting the new self-titled album from John Mellencamp, featuring Your Life Is Now, available in stores. And Princeton University Press, publishers of The Shape of the River by William G. Bowen and Derek Bach, an examination of race-sensitive college admissions policies and their long-term consequences. In bookstores or on the web, pup.princeton.edu. This is NPR, National Public Radio.